From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two writers who've created works based on their own health problems and their encounters with mainstream and alternative medicine. We'll hear from Spalding Gray. His comic monologue and book, Gray's Anatomy, is about his adventures on the fringes of alternative medicine, looking for a way to cure his failing left eye without undergoing the surgery his doctor recommended. Lynn Sharon Schwartz's new novel, The Fatigue Artist, is based on her own experiences with chronic fatigue syndrome. Also today, to upgrade or not to upgrade, commentator Stephen Levy considers the relentless pace of computer technology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bill Bradley today raised the possibility of an independent bid for the White House. Bradley announced yesterday that he would not seek a fourth term in the Senate. He did say he would not challenge President Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. An environmental organization says that during the peak farming months of summer, weed killers run off into the water supply and concentrations of suspected carcinogens in Midwestern tap water are dangerously above federal health standards. From Chicago, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Atrazine is the number one herbicide used by corn and sorghum farmers. It was found in the tap water of 28 out of 29 cities. Another popular herbicide, cyanazine, was in the water of 85% of the cities. Richard Wiles is vice president of research at the Environmental Working Group.
But what makes this contamination so serious is the fact that the levels of these weed killers in many major cities routinely exceeded federal health standards for weeks and even months at a time.
Environmental Protection Agency standards allow water systems to exceed maximum levels for less than a year. Officials at Ciba Geigy, which manufactures herbicides, say that their products only cause risk at exposure levels thousands of times higher than those detected in drinking water. In Chicago, I'm Edward Lifson.
Emergency officials on North Carolina's Outer Banks have lifted their mandatory evacuation order. Still, they are encouraging people to stay away until Felix moves further offshore. Adam Huckberg reports from Manteo, North Carolina.
While Felix continues to spin just off the coastline, forecasters do not expect it to turn inland for a few days, if at all. On the North Carolina Outer Banks, flooding has subsided and all roads have reopened. Emergency management spokesman Charlie Hardig says visitors who want to return will now be allowed to do so at their own risk.
I think what we're trying to do is just tell people that the storm is still out there. It still poses a threat. But if you want to come back, you are welcome to come back, and there will be no impediment to your return.
Officials have resumed the ferry boat service that connects some of the more remote Outer Banks islands to the mainland. Waves, however, remain high and beaches remain closed, and Hardig says they'll stay that way until Felix moves on or dies out. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Manteo, North Carolina.
The Senate has decided to go ahead with the hearings into the deadly siege at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, as scheduled, despite a request from the Justice Department for a delay. The request came in a letter released today from the Justice Department, which claimed that the Senate hearings might interfere with a criminal investigation into an alleged FBI cover-up. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 6 points at 4633.45. in active trading of 343 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. American defense officials said today they're concerned about military moves inside Iraq. The Pentagon says it's preparing for a potential military response. But Western diplomats in Kuwait say they had no information to support the U.S. warnings. They note Iraq's military has been conducting exercises for some weeks. And Western military experts speculate that any unusual exercises are likely being made in response to a strengthened American military presence near Jordan. Officials in India say four Western tourists being held by Kashmiri separatists are still alive. The militant group holding the men has threatened to kill them unless India releases more than a dozen Kashmiri militants from prison. In Kashmir, NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Indian officials say they've received recent assurances from the rebel group Al-Faran that the four hostages are alive and in good health. On Sunday, a villager here found the decapitated body of a fifth hostage, Norwegian Hans Ostro. The militant group has threatened to kill the remaining four, including one American, unless India releases 15 Kashmiri militants from prison. India has so far refused to meet that demand. But today, it did announce plans to release 24 Kashmiri prisoners, an action officials here described as routine, claiming it is in no way related to the militant group's demand. Meanwhile, officials here say they have not ruled out staging a rescue attempt of the four hostages. This is Eric Weiner in Srinagar, India.
An explosion outside a busy subway station in Paris has left 16 people injured. Officials say the bomb was planted in a trash can near a newspaper kiosk. It's the second blast in the French capital in 3 weeks. Angry protests continue today following China's second underground nuclear test in 3 months. Japan, China's largest creditor, repeated a threat to cut back on financial aid. The blast at China's remote desert testing site about 1,500 miles west of Beijing was estimated at 4.5 on the Richter scale. The U.S. has expressed regret at the blast. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Spalding Gray, has chronicled his life in a series of comic autobiographical monologues. His latest, Gray's Anatomy, begins about the time he turned 50, when he started losing the vision in his left eye. His doctor recommended surgery, but before checking into a hospital, Gray decided to see if alternative medicine had anything to offer. Gray's Anatomy, which has been published as a paperback book, describes Gray's adventures on the fringes of alternative medicine as he tries nutritional ophthalmology, psychic surgery, and a sweat lodge. P.S. He finally had the surgery. Gray didn't have much experience with doctors as a child because his mother was a Christian Scientist. I asked him to describe the problem with his eye.
I just noticed that when I was reading over my manuscript of my novel, Impossible Vacation, that the page, the print was breaking down, like getting kind of disintegrating or rotting like Swiss cheese. And it bothered me so much I began testing my eyes where I'd cover one eye, and I noticed that in my left eye I could really not get in any of it really in sharp focus. And was really troubled by that because I could hold it as close to my eye as possible in a way. So I thought, oh boy, this hasn't got to do with glasses, and I really just put it off until I finished the book. I mean, it was probably 6 months before I just went for a routine eye exam.
When I think there's something wrong, I usually like call the doctor immediately, and get the earliest appointment possible.
Good for you.
Well, it's because I'm paranoid. I always think like if I wait, it's really going to get bad.
Uh-huh.
How did you manage to put it off for so long without worrying yourself to death?
It's funny. I think that I probably am so worried about so many different things that I just thought, well, the saying paranoid, and here I am at the Christian Science Monitor being an ex-Christian Scientist, also that plays into it. But if you say you're paranoid, you also say paranoids have things to be paranoid about. But if you're paranoid, it's selecting that thing. So it's like I thought, well, this is just one of many things that might be bothering me now, and I'll eventually get to the doctor. But also because I was working on the book and was so determined to finish it, and I tell you, that book really took its toll on me because I now have arthritis in my right hand because I wrote it over a six-year period and it was 1,900, you know, hand-type pages, but written that would be twice as much. And so now my right knuckle and thumb are pretty crippled from holding the pen with that terrific power and strength. So now I can't write anymore. I'm saved. I just have to talk. I can't write. I can write poetry and that's about it.
Does this make you regret doing the book?
No, I just didn't know a book could injure me in that kind of way because I still am convinced that it did this to my left eye, you know.
Right.
There's two parts of me, which I try to talk about in the monologue. There's the one that, I think there's a Thomas Pynchon quote that I lifted for one of the only play that I ever wrote for a character in a collection called Orchids. And it says this paranoia and then this anti-paranoia, which is much more frightening because you simply cannot get a hold of anything to be afraid of. And that in the monologue is represented by my doctor saying to me, the specialist, he says, this condition is idiopathic, meaning no known cause. So then you're really floating out there because you haven't got anything to hitch on to and you're just saying, we don't know what this is, so we're going to have to go through with the operation. Whereas the other part of me was sure that it had to have some sort of cause. And I did, you know, blame it on the novel and got into this kind of Jungian interpretive thing where you can say left eye represents the female aspect, the dark shadow side, the mother side. I went blind because I was because I had a blind spot about my mother's whatever, and I could fill in the blanks there, her madness, her dark side. You know, you could just run with that, and I could still do that. I could still analyze that to the nth degree. That didn't bring back my sight.
Your doctor recommended surgery. But you wanted to try alternative therapies.
But my doctor said the doctor I went to see, the second one, said there's no rush on this because I had a condition called macula pucker, and there are macula puckers that do 1%, whatever that means, clear up on its own. And I actually met someone who had that happen. So always you're thinking, well, maybe, of course I'm going to wait because I may be the one percentile. And all they do is tell you to wait. They don't say there's any diet involved or cutting back on drinking, although I did stop drinking because I was very worried about affecting my eyesight in any way during that time. And so what I was entering into is trying to enter into a state of healthy consciousness where I would try alternatives. And what happened was that there are so many out there. And they are done in such a fundamentalist kind of, you know, we have the answer way, that I was bouncing from alternative. I never found the one, and I didn't, because of my kind of reporter temperament anyway, since a part of me was the person doing research, the monologist, I said, well, let's check out another one. And I could never find one that I could really sit with, and I finally gravitated back, as I probably somewhere knew in me that I would, to this doctor. And seeing Richard Nixon, actually, in his office, put me over the edge in a funny sort of way.
Right, you thought you were hallucinating, but Richard Nixon really walked into his office.
Well, I thought the man had a mask on at first. I thought it was a Nixon mask. And you know, you've read the book. It's published by Vintage. And it's just a sign of the times. Vintage, the lawyers at Vintage are so, talk about being paranoid. Wanting to change all the situations in the book and all the people's names, and they actually wanted to take out the Nixon story, which is beyond me. You know, I don't understand it. Public figure now deceased.
You say in your book that what you wanted was magic. You didn't want surgery. You wanted some kind of magical cure that would just heal you and fix it. Did you believe that was possible?
There's a part of me that does. When I talk of parts, I do feel that I'm still not whole. Not a whole. No, I'm operating from many different areas, and sometimes there's the illusion of wholeness when I'm looking in a mirror, but mostly not. And so there was the part that, and I was going to say now the Christian Scientist part, but I don't think that it's just as simple as Christian Science. I think that all of us have this baby or magical child in us, the magical thinking that goes on that we never really leave. And I was reminded of that when I was here. I'm here in Washington, D.C. now, and I saw a road production of The Angels in America. And it was part one, and what an epic piece. And, of course, the angel is threatening to come all the time. We have all sorts of fluttering of wings, and then it appears at the end, and I was chilled. Now, I haven't experienced a chill like that in the theater that I can remember. And I realized at that point, it went through the audience, too. I'm sure it was in the audience. It was a whole big chill. And I know that that came from, and I would even include Karl Marx in this, that all of us have a great unconscious, sometimes getting more conscious, need for divine intervention.
Let's talk about some of, or at least one of the people who you went to hoping that they could heal you. I mean, one of the people was a nutritional ophthalmologist.
No, that's a funny man. Because I changed the names, although I kept the fact that it was a configuration of two brothers and an 89-year-old mother. And they did have bottle-thick glasses, and they were in New Jersey. And I changed them to Nutley, which seemed like an appropriate town for them from the original one that were in. And then I changed their names because for the book and also for the show, actually, because I was advised to do that. Now, I got a call from him, from the doctor, and he left, please call me back on my machine. And I kept avoiding him because I was sure he was going to try to sue me. And he finally got a hold of me and he said, we found out that you're telling a story about us at Lincoln Center, and my mother and brother and I all want tickets because we can't wait to see it. And I thought, oh my God, I got to put this off until the last show because it's just they're not going to receive this well the way I depict them, which is pretty nutty, and they are pretty nutty. And so they came the last night, and before they came, because one of the brothers was an opera singer, sang for the Metropolitan Opera, the assistant, and I tell about that in the monologue. His brother, who's the doctor, requested that the ex-opera singer brother get up on stage and do an aria after my monologue at Lincoln Center at the Beaumont. And I immediately said, we'd have union problems. So he said, is there a way we could have a spotlight on him and he'd stand in his seat? And I said, no, I'm afraid we can't do that. They did come. I did the show. It was very difficult to get through it because I was very, very conscious about that section. I thought I was going to stutter when I got to it. Afterwards, they were there with their mother. They drove in from New Jersey. She's 91 now. She's still skiing. She cross-country skis now, not downhill, at 91. And they were waiting with their cameras and autograph books. They thought it was superb. And a week later, I got a notarized letter from him saying, please change our name and address back to the actual name and address. And I didn't do it, but it was notarized saying, we give you permission to tell the truth.
That's great. What did the nutritional ophthalmologist tell you that you should do to heal your eye?
Well, mainly what he wanted to start with was a complete regime of health, you know, that was for the whole body, because the eye is just, you know, one window to the soul, one portion of the body, and of course it's being affected by the whole condition. So it was a raw vegetable diet was mainly it, and all coffee, alcohol, tobacco, any kind of stimulants, any kind of that traditional lovely pleasurable poisons had to go.
So how has your life changed by having to eat only raw vegetables and not any other, not cooked foods, not chicken, fish, no coffee, no cigarettes. Well, you don't smoke anyways, no alcohol.
Well, the way that it changed was that, I said, I'll do this as an experiment, you know, and what it did was cause enormous intestinal gas. That's one way that it changed, you know, and I just had to be very selective about who I was around. It had to be people that really loved and accepted me, and that was minimal. And boring, you know, not interested in going shopping, not looking forward to mealtimes, but also a lightness, you know, it added to a kind of lightness of consciousness, just a more like you're about to be blown away in the wind, or by your own wind, for that matter.
My guest is Spalding Gray. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Spalding Gray. His latest monologue, Gray's Anatomy, which is also published in book form, is about his adventures on the fringes of alternative medicine, looking for a cure so he could avoid undergoing surgery to save the sight in his left eye. So you went to see a Filipino psychic surgeon. What is the principle they use? What do they tell you about what they're doing?
What they don't tell you, but this psychic surgeon apparently appeared to be putting his hands right in to people's flesh and pulling out huge balls of meat that were supposed to be cancers. But when you're there observing it, you really fall into it. You don't question it. You really, it's like a mass hypnosis. Now, I have to say, I didn't trust him because of his theatrics and the way his cancer balls started to look like the same calf hearts or livers coming out, you know, chicken liver, kind of, you know, same. I didn't know what cancer looked like, but the same kind of consistency each day. So what I did was I was in a small hill town, the Philippines, and I asked different people if they knew of any authentic healers that hadn't been, quote, discovered yet. And I was told it was one named Paul up in the hills, or biblical for me, and I went up there, and he was just in a small grass hut. His wife had two small children, and it was a dirt floor. His wife said he wasn't there today. He was out doing healings in the villages for nothing, you know, and his social work. Now, I thought, this man is probably the real thing. This man is a real psychic surgeon who's not going to rip me off. And he came to my hotel with his 2-year-old son, and immediately I thought, oh, family man, He's so honest-looking. And I said, will you come to my hotel room and operate on me? Because with the other psychic surgeon, you had to be there in a huge group, and it was all Japanese that didn't speak any English, and the blood was flying everywhere. I describe it in the book. It's incredible. And this man would come to my room and give me an operation. It was for $50 each time he touched me. And he went up my body. I lay naked on my hotel bed. And he, every time he tweaked my body with his hands, blood would come out. But not spraying like the other one. Just little patches of fresh blood. Until he got up to my left eye, which was the problem. And he pulled out what looked like, I would say, something the size of a shrimp embryo. And threw it into a glass of water with all the other gauze. So this water was... this glass had some water in it, but mainly my blood, supposedly. Now, after he did this a couple of times to me, I said to him, show me how you make the blood come. And he said, I am not a magician. I'm a healer. And I said, well, I'm going to take the blood. And I took the glass, and he chased me into my kitchen. He said, you can't have that. It's polluted. And I said, no, it's my blood. I'm taking it with me back to America.
But you wanted to check to see if it was your blood or not?
Yeah. And so I poured it into a plastic water bottle, not sterilized, and put it up on a shelf. He still wanted it back. I wouldn't give it to him. I sat down with my notebook and I asked him how to spell his last name, which was a mistake. And he said, are you here to write or get healed? Because if you're here to write, and this is the old story, isn't it? If you ask too many questions, you're not going to get healed kind of thing. If you're here to write about this, you're not going to be healed. And I ended up liking him even more. The more he scolded me, and I chased him down to his summer retreat house, which was another little shack on the China Sea, and some cab drivers took me for the 20-minute, you know, everything is 20 minutes, but it wasn't. It was two drivers driving for an hour and a half. And he did some more operations on me down there. I really invested in this man and got to the point where I put full faith in him. Got the blood back to San Francisco, and I was doing a benefit for George Coates Performix Works, and I said, in exchange for the benefit, you take this to a forensic lab, have an assistant do it, and get it analyzed. And because everyone was sure it couldn't be analyzed because it hadn't been refrigerated, and it wasn't, you know, hygienic in any way. But this forensic lab evidently was able to, because I was down in San Antonio, and I got a fax saying, your blood has been analyzed. It's bovine. You have the blood of a cow.
Do you see, I always figure, well, there is such a thing as the placebo effect, and darn it, yeah. I'm going to have that work for me as much as it can. So well, I always figure, like, to the extent that I can believe in something, I'm going to believe in it, because at the very least, it's going to help that placebo effect kick in, and I want it.
Can't do it. As long as you're involved in dialectical thinking, and you cannot not be in that, because you get back to the old Freudian statement of every statement implies it's way before Freud. Take it back to Plato, but every statement implies its opposite, so that you're immediately thinking of the opposite. It's the old thing of how do you turn a pot of water into gold if you could stir it without thinking of elephants, what's the first thing you think of? And so I don't understand how one, I can see, I don't understand what, how one would have faith. I don't know what that is about. I think it must be a magnificent thing. I don't think I will know it in my lifetime. I did have, though, an incident that I still can't explain happened to me in Santa Cruz, and I think it came from being out in California too long, and I'm trying to stay away from California, and I've done it by coming to Washington, D.C., which is the other country. And I had taken some psilocybin mushrooms with a couple of men and gone down into a redwood forest. Now, it was not a heavy dose. There was not a lot of hallucination going on. There was a lot of camaraderie, a kind of grooving on nature. And we had been down there a number of hours, so it was losing its effect. And I would say that I was approaching sobriety. Not that that can even exist in California. I mean, you just go from one state into another state of magical thinking, in my opinion. At least when I'm out there, I'm stimulated to do that. So we're coming out of the redwoods, and we're in a field, and it's beautiful. 400 or 500 acres up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, looking over the Pacific Ocean, and it's just become dark. And coming up the coast is this suspended, flashing, triangular, hovering thing, craft. And I stop and turn in my tracks and go, wow, wait a minute, guys, look, what is that? And they both turn to me as though they'd rehearsed this thing and say, oh, they always come around Santa Cruz at sundown, you know, and if you're really quiet, one will land. I said, what do you mean one will land? Those spaceships that land in Santa Cruz. You're kidding. I went, oh, I see another one. And I got down on my knees, Terry, and I said, please, please land. And later they told me that it was airplanes coming up from Monterey. And they come straight up, and then they turn east over Santa Cruz. So they really are coming straight up the coast. And you're seeing them as though they're hovering right over the trees. but they're really in a kind of steady line coming up, so you're seeing their front lights. Now, I didn't know who I was at that moment, and they were apologetic for putting me on, and I was so happy that I was able to be put on. I thought there was this true believing child in me that I thought was completely gone, one without irony, this very innocent being.
So you finally got surgery for your eye.
Yeah.
What was the outcome?
The outcome was that he was very conservative in his promises, but the outcome was that I was had a 2200 acuity. Now, those are just numbers. I'm sure they mean nothing to you. They would mean something to you if they could hold up a lens over your eye to make that acuity, and then you'd say, oh, yeah, that's 2200. So I was not seeing very well, and after the operation, it came down to 2070. Now, that is a big difference, but it's not a big difference when your eye has been bandaged for 2 weeks and you don't have the memory, you don't have the visual memory of the 2200. So you still haven't got perfect eyesight in your left eye. And you're thinking, that's what I want back. And there's this other voice saying, "This something has changed in you physically that will never be the same again." And so that was a first real sense of old age immortality in a very real way. And so I now have a kind of ghost floating in the middle of my eye where I'm right-eyed, and I'm praying every day to my right eye. I mean, I give thanks for the right-eyed vision. It's relatively clear.
Okay, when you say you're praying for your right eye, I want to know how literally you mean that.
Well, when I pray, I appreciate. I appreciate in the face of when I say get discouraged and start complaining, and I say I still have my vision. And mainly what does that, and when I say prayer, it's an appreciation that comes when I see and have enormous now feeling for and relationship to blind people in any situation, mainly on the streets when I see them. And most recently, I've taken up downhill skiing. And has been enormously powerful event for me. In fact, I've been working on a new piece about that, which I'm testing out in Martha's Vineyard this summer, a new monologue on learning to ski at 53. And my fantasy is to teach blind people to downhill ski. I mean, that's my fantasy of what I want to do in old age.
So when you talk about praying for your right eye, you're talking about
giving thanks.
Giving thanks.
Yeah.
To?
That just goes out. Just goes out, oh, wow, thanks, oh, my God. You know, I'm saying God all the time. So I must, as the Philippine waiter said, you're praying all the time, sir. I said, what do you mean I'm praying? You're saying, oh, my God, another beer. Oh, my God, I'm a God. And if I do cry out to God, and I do it, it's when I'm skiing, and I come to the edge of a cliff and look out over that landscape and go, oh, my God, I don't think I've ever said it so many times. So I kind of equate that with skiing and blindness.
You know, in your monologue in Grey's Anatomy, you say that somebody told you that you were living through the Bermuda Triangle of health.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and do you think you're there?
I thought it was one of those nice little kind of superstitious joke phrases. It was Renee's mother that said it, and it was like, you know, it's nice to think that such a thing exists because you like to think that once you get past, and I am 54 now, so I'm past it, that it's a clearer sailing, but it's you know, it certainly is not. I now have a torn meniscus in my left knee, the cartilage of my knee, that I tore on the way to go skiing, not even skiing, and it was a ski accident that I had just taking a bag out of the back of a car. Threw my back out skiing down a glacier, have a cataract in my left eye, have a mild hernia, have tingling in my left shoulder that they say is something to do with a pinched vertebra that might be old whiplash injury. And, you know, if I went through the whole body, it's the landscape of coming into age.
Well, Spalding Gray, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on again, Terry.
Spalding Gray, his monologue, Gray's Anatomy, is also published as a paperback book. He'll perform the monologue again in early November in Sewanee, Tennessee and Wilmington, Delaware. Next Monday on Martha's Vineyard, he'll perform his show, Gray on Gray. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, the fatigue artist. Novelist Lynn Sharon Schwartz based her new novel on her own experience with chronic fatigue syndrome. Also, the upgrade conundrum. Commentator Stephen Levy wonders whether the constant push to keep up with computer technology is worth the money and the effort.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Retiring Senator Bill Bradley today raised the possibility of an independent run for presidency. Yesterday, Bradley announced that he would not seek a fourth term in the Senate. At a news conference today in Washington, Bradley said Americans have come to depend too much on public officials for answers.
Only a president can affect the lives of people in this country is, I think, a question that we need to look at very carefully. I pointed out several months ago in a speech I gave on civil society a quote from Bertolt Brecht where somebody says, "Pity the nation that has no heroes," to which Galileo, the other character, says, "Pity the nation that needs them."
Bradley, who has been a critic of the Clinton administration, also confirmed today that he would not mount a challenge to the president within the Democratic Party, but Bradley said he has not ruled out the possibility of running as a third-party candidate. A UN report that ranks countries on the basis of human development places the U.S. in second place behind Canada. But when it comes to the treatment of women, the United States fares less well, NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The report ranks 174 countries on the basis of life expectancy, educational attainment, and purchasing power. Globally, it finds that women and girls still constitute 70% of the world's poor and two-thirds of the world's illiterates. They occupy only 14% of managerial and administrative jobs. In the U.S., women fare far better and occupy about 40% of these jobs, as well as making up over half of the professional and technical workers. However, while the U.S. once led in gender equality, the report now finds it's in fifth place when it comes to income, education, and health. And the U.S. is in eighth place when it comes to advancing women's political and economic needs. The report's authors conclude that women's advances, particularly in Nordic countries, can be attributed to affirmative action and quotas. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The Commerce Department reported today the U.S. trade deficit climbed to its second highest level in history. The $11.3 billion imbalance came as a big drop in U.S. exports offset a similar decline in imports of cars and consumer goods. Economist Bob Diedrich says he thinks the deficit will remain high.
Well, we continue to think there should be some abatement in response to the slowdown, which has should begin to have a bigger effect on imports than it has to date. The foreign markets look as if they're still pretty good, and that should help exports. I wouldn't expect, though, we're going to have a dramatic move.
The monthly deficit was up almost 2.5% from the revised May imbalance. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 8.5 points to close at 4630.63. Advances led declines 11 to 10. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Members of Mickey Mantle's family have outlined plans for the Mickey Mantle Foundation in Dallas. The baseball legend has vowed to publicize the need for organ donors before he died. From member station KERA in Dallas, Bill Zeeble reports.
Mantle's wife and three sons say it was important to Mickey that they carry on the awareness of organ donors. As a result, the recently formed Mickey Mantle Foundation will distribute 1 million donor cards at the nation's baseball parks over Labor Day weekend. They'll resemble baseball trading cards with a reproduction of Mantle's autograph on it. The foundation's slogan came from Mantle. He said, "Be a hero, be a donor." In the future, other athletes may also contribute to the effort. Olympic track star Carl Lewis already has. He's given $25,000 to the cause. In 1996, the year when the Olympics are played in Atlanta, Lewis's likeness will appear on cards that get distributed. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
The Defense Department says U.S. forces are taking new steps to prepare for possible response to increased military activity in Iraq. Troops in the U.S. assigned to units that would take the lead in a quick deployment to the Persian Gulf are being told to stay aware of developments. Western diplomats in Kuwait dismissed the Iraqi troop activity, noting that it may just be a response to joint U.S.-Jordanian maneuvers near Jordan. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole today urged President Clinton not to lift sanctions against the former Yugoslavia until a final settlement is reached in the country's four-year-old war. The call came in a letter from Dole to President Clinton, who was vacationing in Wyoming. United Nations officials say Croatia has doubled its military strength and fortifying defenses in preparation for a possible confrontation against rebel Serbs in nearby hills. And an environmental group said today that people in the Midwest are sometimes drinking water with dangerously high levels of herbicides. The Environmental Working Group says the concentrations are sometimes too high. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neurologist Oliver Sacks has said, any disease introduces a doubleness into life, an it, with its own needs, demands, and limitations. The new novel, The Fatigue Artist, opens with that quote. The novel proceeds to chronicle one 40-year-old woman's mysterious loss of energy, how she is transformed by illness, and how she looks for help in conventional medicine and acupuncture. My guest is novelist Lynn Sharon Schwartz. Her other novels include Disturbances in the Field, Leaving Brooklyn, and Rough Strife. In the Los Angeles Times, Daphne Merkin said about Schwartz, "It's good to have an interpreter of our tribal doings." Here's a short reading by Schwartz from The Fatigue Artist, in which the main character first notices her symptoms.
"I dropped my keys on the way in. That's the latest symptom. Things leap from my hands. Mostly small, slippery things. Bottle caps, paper clips, the pen as I write this, but often larger things as well, magazines or socks or fruits I'm squeezing at the open-air market. Thoughts, too, slide from my grasp, but that's another story. I've been worried lately about the things dropping, the supernatural exhaustion, the hypersensitivity to noise, not to mention the more mundane signs, sore throats, headaches, stomach cramps. Oh, and not minding the heat. Everyone complains that the weather is tropical, unbearable, but I haven't noticed except in a mental way. I hear bulletins on the radio. I check the thermometer. It's because I myself am so hot. Not my skin especially, but inside. No sudden waves of heat, such as my former editor Gretchen, a case of early menopause, would describe when she phoned to prod me about my books, but a steady heat steaming out from the center with each thump of my heart, clouding me with mist. Feverish people say they're on fire, but I feel like the cauldron itself containing a stew that simmers dully along, or like a bag of sand left out in the sun. Between the outside weather and the inner is no disparity. The weather is merely my projection. They say illness makes you solipsistic, the world a mere projection or translation. If this is illness, it could be any number of things. I'm not eager to find out."
So what is the diagnosis for your heroine?
Ultimately, she finds out that she has a chronic fatigue virus, which can come in many forms, and the book becomes a search, a kind of quest for where did it come from? How did she get it? As you know, a lot of people don't believe this exists at all, but many forms of it are a virus that's detectable, and she has a virus, so she has a respectable form of it. But still, she feels that it's not so much, not only a virus, but it's some kind of vulnerability, and she tries to find out what it is in her life, in her society, in her past, what that has left her open to this invasion, and that's how she thinks of it. And in the course of it, she gets to investigate quite a bit about contemporary urban life.
Why did you want to make illness a central part of your story?
Well, that it's for a very personal reason, because I, too, had an illness of this kind, and I began to write the book as my own quest, which is somewhat different from the heroine's, and she's quite different from me, my own quest was to be able to do something. While I had the illness, I didn't know how long I would have it. In fact, I was sick, pretty sick, 3 or 4 months, and then spent 2 years in a sort of semi-sick state, but I was getting about. But I didn't know. I thought I might be sick for much longer, and I didn't want to waste the time. I wanted to feel that when I emerged from this, and I was determined to emerge, I would have something. I'm a writer, and what I wanted to have was a book. And so I started writing the book in an attempt to find a way to live with the illness, kind of incorporate it into what I did. I felt since it was in me and it was feeding on me, then I would feed on it too, and we'd have a kind of symbiotic relationship.
That's a nice way of looking at it.
I try to find a good way to look at it, yes.
Laura, your main character, doesn't go to the doctor immediately. It takes her a while, and all of her friends start urging her to see somebody. She finally does. How long did it take you to actually see somebody?
Not very long, because both of us have had bad experiences with doctors, but she was much more angry and reluctant to go to a doctor than I was. And I had quite a nice doctor, and I went and was told, it took one or two visits with the blood tests and so forth, and finally he said, look, this is what you've got. It was an Epstein-Barr virus, he called it. And he said, there's not much I can do for you. Rest, but don't rest too much. And he said a lot of things that were kindly, and he tried to be helpful, but there wasn't much he could do. And eventually I did seek out Chinese medicine, just as Laura in the book does, with a character I call the witch. And that worked out very well. I felt that I was helped by it.
What did you like about acupuncture?
Well, it's very restful. You just lie there, and the needles go into you, and they start stirring your energy around. It wasn't that I liked having the needles in me. I didn't feel them. They're not painful. But I had a wonderful acupuncturist, and I felt that she transmitted something very healing in her treatment, and she was very encouraging. What was most encouraging was the fact that she insisted that I would get better, and I felt I was not in this alone anymore. That there was someone with me and someone was taking care, and it would be over at some point.
And the fatigue artist, your main character, Laura, is kind of dropping things, and she feels dropping things is just almost a symbol of what's going on in her life, that things are just kind of out of her control. And the acupuncturist suggests to her that she eats tight foods that cohere around a core, like Brussels sprouts or cabbage. And in that respect, acupuncture can be a very almost metaphorical mm-hmm. approach to medicine. As a writer who uses metaphors in your work, right. How did you feel about using a system of medicine that also uses metaphor?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you really put your finger on it, because I love that this whole book is built on the idea of metaphor, of things being translated into other things, just as the Tai Chi teacher in the book and the translator work together. So I think I didn't really think of it until you said it, but maybe what does appeal to me and did in Chinese medicine is that everything is a metaphor. Everything is a metamorphosis into some other form. Now, I don't know if this really is true for tight foods or loose foods, but I like to think of it because it makes the universe not only a poetical place, but it makes it, in a way, a more orderly, cohesive place, a more understandable place. Things are not chaotic, but there are certain basic principles, or certain basic shapes or paradigms that keep repeating themselves over and over.
Lynn Sharon Schwartz is my guest. Her new novel is called The Fatigue Artist. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lynn Sharon Schwartz. Her new novel is called The Fatigue Artist. It's about a woman who gets a form of chronic fatigue syndrome, which Lynn Sharon Schwartz also had for a time. I'm wondering what it was like for you to have an illness that a lot of people don't really believe exists.
Well, there were people who didn't think there was anything wrong with me. People tell you you're depressed or you're tired or you're evading life. But most people, I must say, were sympathetic. As with any illness, with friends and family, you know, people are very concerned at the beginning. And then the longer it goes on, they kind of forget. And I've done this myself with friends who have had long-term illnesses. At the beginning, you shower more attention on the person, and then you forget, or you think, well, they should be better by this time. So everybody was fine, except that I felt it's a very isolating illness. Another thing is that it's not an illness that makes you look terrible. You get a lot of sleep, and if you wish, you can eat right. So you don't look bad. You don't look ravaged by anything. And people would always say, oh, you look wonderful. And I'd say, well, yes, I'm getting a lot of sleep. And I didn't have to say, I didn't tell them. Maybe it was 10, 12, 14 hours a day. Plenty of rest. I did look stressed. There were people who were very close to me. My sister, for example, could see that I looked anxious and bewildered. But mostly I looked all right. So there's that problem. It was isolating. It was not a good experience all around.
Were you able to write when you were sick?
Yes, that was a saving grace. And I'm so glad that I'm able to write through almost anything. I couldn't do much else. But I wrote this book, although the book turned out to take longer than the illness. I wanted them to end simultaneously. I had this kind of mystical connection in my mind. But the way the book got written was a way of dealing with the illness. I would lie on my bed, and there was a point at the very beginning, the first 3 or 4 months, I could read a little bit, but it was hard to concentrate on difficult material. I could read magazines. But what I could do was talk on the phone. I could talk and I could listen. I'm a very auditory person. And I would talk to friends. I'd have these long gossipy conversations, mostly with women friends, and they'd tell me stories. And he did this and I did this and we said this. And I found when I would hang up, I brooded over these stories because I didn't have anything else to think about. And I became very involved in the anecdotes people were telling me, and I was living through my ear. Things were coming in. And after a while, I got the idea of writing down what I was hearing after one particularly fascinating anecdote from a friend. And I began to write down everything people said to me. And, you know, I love to write, and I write with a pen when I write my books. I start out with a pen, and later I put them on a computer. But the act of writing with a pen in a notebook feels to me like I am living, I am functioning. And so I wrote down all these stories. And before I knew it, I had a notebook full of stories, gossip, which I could never possibly print because you can't do that to your friends. But I had stories. I typed them up, I put them on the computer, and by this time I was beginning to get better, a little better, able to sit up at a computer sometimes an hour or two a day. I would seize whatever energy I had. If I got up at 6 o'clock and I had energy, I'd go to the computer then and then sleep the rest of the day. And soon I had a pile of wonderful material, and I thought, is there any way I can transform these stories into a narrative? First, I had to change all the stories drastically the reasons I've already stated, because you don't want to take people's lives. So I changed them all, and then I tried to find a heroine who could somehow weave them into a narrative, who could either embody them, live these stories, or have friends who live these stories. And that's how the book took shape.
I don't know if you've been through this yourself, but I found that my experience of being sick as a child is really different from my experience as being sick as an adult. I was never very sick as a child. And so if I had the flu for a few days, terrific. You know, you don't have to go to school. My mother would wheel in the little portable TV into my bedroom, and I could sit and watch television most of the day. And it was actually a very pleasant break. Being sick as an adult is really, there's just no advantage to it. You know, even when I get to take off a day from work, what I end up doing is working at home while still feeling sick. It doesn't buy you anything as an adult like it did when you were a kid. Did you go through this yourself?
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. When you were talking about being sick as a child, I felt the same way, although we didn't have the portable TV. I'm older, I think. But yes, it was fun to stay home from school and all the things you stated. I had scarlet fever as a child, and my mother was quite worried and kept me in for 6 weeks. But I only remember having a wonderful time and eating lots of ice cream and reading lots of books and so on. But I, aside from that, I was not very sick either. As an adult, I hate being sick, and I think it's maybe because we feel our own mortality, and maybe we know what sickness means. And we worry, and the older we get, of course, the more we worry. I mean, when you're sick in your 20s or 30s, of course, it's a drag and you don't like it. But when you're sick in your 40s or 50s, you always worry. Maybe this is the real illness. You know, my terminal illness is coming. Maybe I will never again. It's that feeling of never again that you don't have as a child. As a child, you know you'll get better. You assume you'll get better. But as an adult, with this illness, for example, I felt maybe I'll never again be able to run for a bus, or I'll never again be able to swim laps, or many things that I would do. Never again be able to stay out late at night and go dancing. As it turned out, I recovered and I'm able to do these things. But it's that feeling, this may be it. The sense of loss is not only unpleasant, but there's an element of panic in being sick, I think, now.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, there's certainly an element of panic and chronic fatigue. I don't know if you've been sick as an adult, but if you have, you know what that panic feels like.
Do you feel very vulnerable now, even though you're better?
Yeah, I feel I have to be careful. I do think that viruses remain in the body, but they're dormant, and they can be awakened, and I don't know by what. So I have a sense of being more careful, maybe, than getting enough sleep, and I wouldn't overeat or overdrink. I probably wouldn't overdrink anyway because I can't. I fall asleep. But I'm more careful physically than I really want to be. And I think as time passes, I won't have to be so careful. I've now felt better for about a year and a half or so. And more, I don't think about chronic fatigue. But I know it's there. I almost have a funny relationship with the virus now. I feel I have to keep it at bay. I have to propitiate it, be good to it so it'll stay quiet. Like, feed it the way you feed a giant in a cage, to keep it still and not provoke it. But this is all magic that I do in my head, and I don't claim that it has any basis in reality.
Lynn Sharon Schwartz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lynn Sharon Schwartz's new novel is called The Fatigue Artist. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, are you tracking Hurricane Felix?
You bet, Terry. Hurricane Felix has slowed down, in fact. There's not much to track at the moment. Its progress toward the Atlantic coast has slowed. We'll have the latest position and prediction. Richard Harris also explains how it is that hurricanes get started and how they gain in strength. I'll talk with the UNHCR spokesman in Banja Luka, Bosnia, about the exodus of Croats and Muslims. They're being pushed out of the Banja Luka region. Also, New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley has announced he is leaving the Senate after his term is up, won't run for re-election, and will remember John Cameron Swayze, the veteran television newscaster and Timex spokesman.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As Microsoft gets ready to sell its new operating system, Windows 95, PC and business computer users are wondering what to do. Wait and see, or take the plunge and upgrade? Technology commentator Stephen Levy has these thoughts on a modern-day headache, the upgrade conundrum.
On August 24th, a lot of computer users are going to be faced with a decision they didn't count on when they first procured their Compaqs, IBMs, and Packard Bells. Should they undergo a costly and confusing upgrade to something called Windows 95? I should explain that Windows 95 is what is known as an operating system, a kind of Uber software that controls the computer's functions and acts as an orchestra leader for other programs you might use. Made by Microsoft, Windows 95 is the designated, spiffed-up, and supercharged replacement for Windows 3, the current choice. Despite the fact that we're only talking about a suffix change, this shift is a big deal, the most hyped event in the Silicon world in years. Everybody's got to cope with it. But in another way, the coming of Windows 95 is only the most prominent example of a chronic dilemma of the computer age, the upgrade conundrum. Computers, you see, are the ultimate bait-and-switch machine. Every time someone buys one, there's a rush of pride in that he or she has managed, for a mere few thousand bucks, to procure something that only a couple decades back would have cost millions of dollars and belonged more in the exotic realm of James Bond plots than in your home office. On the other hand, the same forces that make computers such wonderful bargains, the technological advances that assure that silicon marvels keep getting cheaper and more powerful, are working overtime to make sure our present units are obsolete well before we figure out how to use them. I'm not sure this has been implemented in electronic dictionaries yet, but a good synonym for a six-year-old computer is doorstop. But even before a computer gets that old, the software you started out with, from the operating system to the word processor, is constantly being revamped. You're promised that the new versions will be easier to use, loaded with new features, and purged of the most annoying aspects of the original. Sounds good, huh? But wait a minute. Most times, you have to pay for these upgrades. And then come the hidden costs. It's not uncommon for upgrades, like Windows 95, for instance, to demand more power from your computer, more memory, bigger disk drives, sometimes even an entirely new machine. And then you have to take time to learn all those new commands and routines, stuff you'll have to relearn again when the next upgrade comes. It's no mystery why the technology companies make these upgrades. Instead of having to find new customers, they keep their corporate hand in the pocket of existing customers. Their official justification is that upgrading will make us more productive. But our big gain in productivity really came the day we got our computer. In comparison to the shift from pencils to typewriters to monitors and chips, those other changes are just fine-tuning, fixing bugs, adding frills, and addressing annoyances that shouldn't have been there in the first place. Case in point is one of the most touted features of Windows 95, the ability to use more than 8 letters or characters to name a file or document. That this limitation existed in previous versions of Windows was something of a scandal. After all, Macintosh users have been freed of it since 1984. But long file names are being touted as one of Windows 95's greatest features, and I'm quite serious when I note that millions are salivating, drooling, I say drooling, at the prospect of naming a file Letter to Grandma, instead of GMOM1DOC. That sort of refinement isn't necessarily a cost-effective benefit, but something that makes users feel good, not only about their computers, but about themselves. And that's why I think that ultimately, the decision to upgrade is less of a pragmatic imperative than a lifestyle choice. A 10-year-old Ford Escort will get you to the mall, but isn't it nicer to cruise in a new Cherokee wagon? Every day we make shopping decisions based on factors other than need. There's emotion and status and fear and lust involved, intangible yet compelling reasons to justify lofty price tags. Computer and software upgrades are no different. We like the latest and greatest. Besides, doesn't that nice fellow Bill Gates need the money?
Stephen Levy writes about computers for Newsweek magazine. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.